Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of the Best Anchor Stocks podcast. I know it has been too long since the last episode, but don't worry because these episodes are going to start becoming more recurring. If you don't want to miss any of them, feel free to follow the podcast and I'll be grateful if you leave a review too. In today's episode, I speak with Drew Cohen, co-founder of Speedwell Research. I typically talk about a wide variety of topics in my podcast, but this time we thought it would be a good idea to talk and focus on what makes a company high quality. We'll go over the different traits each of us considers to be present in high quality companies, and we'll share the highest quality company we've ever researched at the end of the episode. Funnily enough, we both thought of the same company when facing this question. I've also written an article about this topic recently, and Drew also has, so I'll share both of those in the description. So without further ado, let's jump right into the episode. Hello and welcome once again to the Best Anchor Stocks podcast. It's been quite a while since the last time I was talking to the to Drew now. I think it's been like 7 or 8 months since the last episode. So I said at the beginning that I was not going to do this on a recurring basis, but I think it's been too long, to be honest. So I think it's a great welcome back to the podcast because we have Drew from Speedwell Research. And I would do an introduction of you, Drew, but I think it's better if you say what you do and what kind of companies you look for.
Yeah, absolutely. So just kind of quick on my background, I started at Goldman Sachs on the sell side, and then later on I moved to Capital Group on the buy side, where I covered a variety of different companies. And sort of my experience there, both writing research on the sell side and consuming it on the buy side, was that a lot of research is not really written for long-term investors. A lot of it's not really focusing on kind of key aspects of the business. And you can read these initiation reports with all these charts and pictures and still not really understand the key value prop of the business, not understand the history, not understand the competitive environment. And that's in part because they really tend to emphasize a lot of graphs, pictures, rather than actual writing. And, you know, this is Jeff Bezos has commented on this when he talks about his 6-page memos and not wanting any sort of PowerPoints in the boardroom. And Steve Jobs says something to a similar effect too. And so we thought it was interesting that even though a lot of managers tend to prefer written content and something that's more thorough and explains sort of the business, it turns out that sell side doesn't do that. And there's different reasons for that. That's probably a different podcast. But in short, we created Speedwell Research to write in-depth research on great companies. The idea is that we'll cover everything about the business from founding history, industry, financial characteristics, competitive environment, and then, you know, conclude with a reverse DCF valuation, see what sort of assumptions you need to make in order for the company to work as an investment. And so that's what Speedwell Research is. So far, we've done 11 research reports on various names. You could go to speedwellresearch.com to see that. And then we separately have a podcast called The Synopsis, which Leandro was just on recently. It was a great interview, well-received. Recommend you check that out if you haven't already. And then we also write memos at speedwellmemos.com.
Mm-hmm. I'll leave all the links in the description. The topic, I mean, in the podcast we did a couple of weeks ago, it wasn't a specific topic. We talked about many things, but I think it's a good idea that in this episode we focused on a specific topic, right? And I think it's an interesting one because it's one that's very subjective, but at the same time, very important. And I think that just demonstrates how the challenging nature of investing, right? Because there's a lot of qualitative research involved. And obviously, it's not just the data, but also how you interpret the data. So we're going to talk about what is a high quality company, right? A lot of people talk about quality, but a lot of people tend to have different definitions for it, right? What fits your mold of a high quality company might not fit the mold of a high quality company of another investor. And that's perfectly fine, right? But I think that these companies have some identifiable traits that are rather relatively common across the people who invest in quality. So the first question is going to be actually quite open and probably very tough. So Drew, what do you think, what are your characteristics of a high quality company? What do you look for in a high quality company?
Yeah, and we talked about this a little bit on our last podcast, and it's obviously something I've thought about. And It's kind of funny because the more you try to delineate and add more sort of factors or characteristics to the definition, the quicker it kind of turns into just this platitude checklist of things to look for that many people would be familiar with. And I think if you want to simplify it down to its essence, it's really just two things. It's a high ROIC and it's durability. But within that, you can definitely parse apart all sorts of different factors as to what really makes something durable, and then how do you actually maintain that high ROIC. But those two are kind of like the main things. And then I also like to split it up a little bit further into kind of thinking about the difference between the financial model, the difference between the product or the assets they may have, as well as management, and then also the growth runway. And so those are kind of like four other ways to kind of delineate it a little bit more. And you could think about it whether or not you have a great business or you have just a great product or asset. And so if you own the Saudi Arabian guar oil fields that produce, you know, a couple million barrels of oil a day, you have a great asset, but do you necessarily have a great business? Well, you know, it's not so clear really, because as soon as that oil field depletes, what really is your business? And maybe, I know you've written about Nintendo too. Nintendo for a long time has clearly had a lot of very valuable IP that they just weren't monetizing it as well. So if you were to look at Nintendo 15 years ago, would you say that it's a great business? I'm not so clear that you would, even though, again, they have great products, IP that people love, and it definitely had a lot of potential. So it is something about this sort of operating model where everything is kind of just working, and it's working in sort of a flawless flawless sort of way where it's not only resilient and it's not only executing in terms of financial performance, but everything is kind of just working as you would expect it to be. And so we could get into some more of the factors as to what actually protects the moat of a high ROIC, and what does it mean to have a high ROIC runway, because there are a lot of businesses you could think of, sort of financial exchanges, for example, where they have a great business. It's very hard to disrupt the Chicago Mercantile Exchange or the NYSE. But they had no real ability to reinvest into their core business. And that's actually a characteristic of a lot of great businesses, is they'll have this impressive financial profile, maybe very high margins, a high ROIC, but there's nothing more you could really do with that. And so your return is very much predicated on the price you're going to pay. Whereas I think we tend to think of great companies as having this growth runway. Whether or not that's a necessary condition, though, I think is up for debate.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I agree with most of what you said there. But before going into those topics, which I think are going to be probably most of the conversation, I think one important topic, or maybe one controversial topic, right, is the past. Because I think a lot of people tend to disregard the past completely. Like, okay, investing is all about the future, right? But I mean, I think the past can teach us quite a lot of things about our business, especially, and also about the future, right? Because if a business has been great for the last, say, two or three decades, you can basically form your opinion based on why it has been so good in the past and what are the probabilities of that excellence continuing in the future, right? Say the reinvestment runway, also why the moat is going to be intact for the next 20 years. So how do you look at the past? And if you do, what do you look for in the past?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we have this piece on Speedwell philosophy, and within it, we kind of talk about the fact that a lot of these great entrepreneurs that build these great businesses, they're trying to solve a problem, and they're basically trying to solve that problem for many decades thereafter. You can look at George Vincent West, who is a founder of Floor Decor. And his problem was there wasn't enough selection of flooring at good prices and convenience. And so he created Floor Decor. And even today, they're still harping on the same sort of value prop that he tried to present. You could look at Jeff Bezos starting Amazon. His whole thesis was how you take advantage of, you know, the unlimited inventory that the internet allows. And Amazon still today, that is their essential value prop. And obviously, they've continued to iterate on that. But you're talking about identifying a problem and continuing to iterate on that. And all of that is deep in the history. And you can see, you know, Moody's, any sort of credit agency, again, their value prop is essentially unchanged from, you know, decades hence. And so there's a lot of businesses where you do see what their value prop is. You see what the problem they're trying to solve. And that's why we do focus a lot on the history. In all of our reports, it's, you know, many dozens of pages just on the history, because essentially with the history, what you're getting at is kind of the initial fumblings of the entrepreneur trying to build the business and the product. And they're finding this sort of product market fit and seeing whether or not there is some sort of value they're really creating. And if they are able to solve this problem and they're able to do it in sort of an organic way, then it does tend to be a pretty resilient business, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And I think one thing that's not discussed a lot, I think we touched on this on your podcast, is the fact that the past also helps investors generate implicit conviction, right? I mean, explicit conviction is the fact that you can look forward and maybe the financial model is going to make sense and the thesis is going to make sense. But if you just look forward, then you will never going to know how a business is going to react against a certain event, right? That's happened in the past. And you can basically trust how the company reacted in the past because that has happened. You don't have to forecast anything. So I think that's also an important point. And you brought before the case of Nintendo, which I agree with you. I wouldn't say that it could be argued that Nintendo 50 years ago was not a great business or 20 years ago, because I would say that just looking at the performance from then, you could say that it has not been a great business in the past, right? It has been extremely cyclical and probably severely under-monetized. And there are a lot of topics behind why that could be the case. But this is a clear case of a company that might be experiencing a turnaround, right? But as a quality investor, it's hard, right, to focus on turnarounds, because I think the probabilities say that a company that's been bad probably is going to remain bad. And obviously there are exceptions, right? But you're trying to hit, this is a game of probabilities, right? So you're trying to fish in the place where that gives you the most probability of enjoying a good return. So have you looked at turnarounds, or how do you go around turnarounds? Because I have a couple on the Best Anchor stock portfolio, but I honestly, I have to be very sure that things are going to be different, right? Because if the past is an indication of the future, then things are not going to go very well.
Yeah, I personally know we don't look at something that's an active turnaround. You know, we wouldn't look at Abercrombie & Fitch a couple of years ago and say, oh, we think that their new style or designs are really going to resonate well with Gen Z. What we will do, though, when we do go into the history, is if it is a turnaround, and RH, that's one of the companies we've written about. If people are unfamiliar with that story, it's probably one of the more incredible turnarounds that really, in my opinion, doesn't get enough airtime. And when Gary Friedman took over that company, they were literally selling dog food biscuits. They were selling all sorts of Chotskis, all sorts of child toys, puzzles, and with all these different sort of mixes of lower quality kind of compulsive goods that they're trying to get people to buy. It obviously had no sort of high-end image at that time, and it was hard to kind of mix that product in with also, you know, this higher-end American furniture that they had at the time. And when he took it over, they were nearing bankruptcy. He put a lot of his own money into it. They had a very traditional mall footprint. The stores were very quirky. And within, you know, 2 decades, he's totally transformed that business entirely from consistently losing money. I think they were only profitable for one quarter on an EBIT basis, not even a net income basis. And after he's taken it over, they've been profitable many times over. They've reached margins as high as 25%, but of course he's still continuing to try to transform that. And so I wouldn't be, you know, eager to be along the ride for when he's transforming it from, you know, this very weird eclectic mix of products into trying to say we're going to have luxury galleries. But once he's actually done that and proven himself out, then I'm more comfortable kind of being there for the next leg, where it's like, we're going to try the same thing in Europe. It's going to be a lot more investment. We're going to push even higher end. We're going to try to invest in these new catalogs and push our price point up, which is kind of where they are now. And there's definitely some pushback. Nothing is ever linear, especially when you're trying to do something as ambitious as they're trying to do. But kind of the idea there that I'm trying to hit on is that the initial turnaround, or when it's, you know, a business in kind of dire constraints, I wouldn't really be interested in. But then when you're talking about a model that's already kind of got its strides and it's working, then it's kind of in its second leg of an improvement. That's much more interesting to me. Because again, you kind of have those proof points of it working.
Yeah, I think I read the other day someone discussing that obviously the most money that you can make in the stock market is probably when you buy an inflection before an inflection point, right before it. But at the same time, what I thought is, okay, yeah, that's obviously true. but you're also incurring somewhat higher risk, right? Because not all inflection points will turn out as you believe they will. So obviously, I remember reading about what Phil Fisher said about this topic. He said that, okay, you can make a lot of money buying a very small company that it's unproven. Obviously, you're going to make a lot of money there, but you can it's maybe an equally good investment to buy that company when it's already established, even if your return is lower, because obviously your assumed risk has been much lower, right? So I think people tend to compare returns to returns, but leaving risk out, and I think that's a bit dangerous. And I think in turnarounds, you see that, right? Because you commented there on Abercrombie. It's had an excellent return over the past years, obviously, after a turnaround. And that might lead people to believe like, oh, wow, like turnarounds work, right? But for each Abercrombie, probably there are a lot of companies that have gone bust. And two, probably when Abercrombie was starting in the turnaround, it was much, much riskier, right? Because the visibility was very low.
No, I think that all makes sense. And that's why we like to kind of be a little explicit with the assumptions that you're making in an investment. And we do that with the reverse DCF. And so you could see if I'm assuming XYZ, this is going to be my associated return. And then you can sensitize the assumptions and you could kind of see, okay, if they do anywhere in the range of this, this is what the return would be. And then you could see where you're comfortable with actually assuming different things. And people always talk about risk reward. The reward is the easiest to calculate. And so to me, it makes the most sense to kind of then back solve for what the risk would be in such a situation. And then you could look at the two. And a lot of times it's kind of hard to think about risk. I think if you're just using like a regular discount rate or something like that, a WACC, and you're saying, I think the stock is underpriced, you don't really know relative what to, because you don't know what's really being assumed in the actual future business performance of the company. And of course, anytime you do a valuation, there's implied future cash flows. And if you're not thinking about explicitly what those assumptions in those future cash flows are, then it's hard to say you have a good grasp on what the risk return is.
No, I completely agree. And at the start of the conversation, you obviously said that a high quality company can be basically simplified into, let's say, a moat and a long range investment runway, right? So you have an opportunity to reinvest at outsized rates of return during a long time, right? So I think let's focus a bit on these two topics. So first, when you're what do you look for in a moat? I mean, there are moats have many shapes and forms. Do you tend to focus on some moats more than others? Do you tend to be uncomfortable focusing on some types of moats, right? Because I know that there are a lot of investors that, for example, a moat that's based on a brand makes them uneasy. And maybe some investors prefer moats that are based on capital intensity, right? Rather than moats that maybe are based on some proprietary technology, because they feel that that can get competed away rather fast. So, what do you look for in a moat?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. And again, there's all sorts of kind of platitudes of different competitive advantages we could list off. I don't want to do that here because I think people are familiar with those. I would say I'm most uneasy with the moats where it seems like there's a risk of it being extinguished. The way I like to think about it is that a good business is basically creating goodwill with their customers over time. And then they're releasing a portion of that goodwill, usually in terms of pricing, right? And so you continue to build up more goodwill with your customer. You're giving them more value. They're enjoying the product or service more. And then you're taking prices up a bit over time to kind of extinguish that. And I think if you're thinking of kind of like the poster child, great operating business model, people always list Costco. And Costco is a company who, I'd be pretty confident they could definitely raise pricing a couple percent since their margin is so thin. I believe it's like 2.5%, 3% right now. And if you're taking pricing up 3%, you could say they're doubling their operating margin. And that was like the next leap point that you should be basically valuing them on what they potentially could be earning, right? This sort of theoretical mature margin. And within that idea is this kind of idea that there's a lot of goodwill, if you want to call it that, built up within the company that could be released in terms of pricing. And so anytime you have a company that is continuing to build more value than they're actually taking, it tends to be very sustainable. The tricky part is that's very few companies. There's very few companies you could list in the arena of Costco. And also on top of that, I'm not sure that you would actually want them to leave as much kind of goodwill, if you will, in the tank as they do. A lot of great companies really push it to the limit of exactly what the market is willing to bear at that time. They're building value and then they're taking pricing up. You know, you can think of Amazon building out a huge logistics network, but they're making all their merchants pay for that. They're taking their take rates up. They're raising, you know, their Prime membership over time. They're pulling out free video services, making it ad-based over time. And so they do want a return on all that investment. And, you know, as a consumer, you obviously prefer to pay less and you want even more for your money, but you do as an investor want there to be some sort of balance. And a lot of companies push into that balance. I just finished this report on CoStar, and a lot of their customers don't really like them. And they don't like them because their pricing is very high. It's pretty opaque. And on top of that, they are very litigious in policing the use of their logins. For those that don't know, CoStar is real estate data analytics, basically. So they have a platform, most comprehensive data on real estate you'll be able to get. And there's no real great substitutes. They're substitutes for particular products, but not across the breadth of data they cover. And they're used by, you know, 95-ish% of all top 1,000 brokers. You know, they have a 98% retention rate for people who've been on the platform over 5 years. And so those are all sorts of things that suggest that even though they are very aggressive in taking their pricing and maybe extracting a lot of goodwill from consumers, it, at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter. They're still kind of stuck on that platform. And you can go to the extreme of that with, you know, some of the businesses Constellation Software has, vertical market software, where you have this mission critical service that customers really just can't pull it off. And then it's also, you know, a small portion of overall expense base. So it's not really a big issue if they take pricing up, but that is, you know, another factor there. No one's probably looking at some old software from 25 years ago, thinking of, you know, how much goodwill they have there, but at the same time, it is still an essential service for them. And so that's kind of a put and take balance of how I would think about it, big picture.
And this brings an interesting topic, because I was thinking about this the other day, right? Amazon has continued to add value to the Prime membership. And okay, price has gone up lately, but it's still severely underpriced, right? For the consumer, not on the merchant side, right? Because the merchants are getting increasingly squeezed. Do you think that can be even negative over the long term, in the sense that once you want to take that goodwill, you've alienated customers into thinking that prices were going to remain low for so long? Or, I mean, it's like the debate between raising prices a bit every year as you build value, or basically building like a huge stretch between the value and the price, and then eventually start closing the gap.
Yeah, I mean, if we think about an LTV, a long-term customer value calculation, there's two real inputs to that, right? You have revenues, and then you have churn, or the duration, how long the customer is going to actually be there. And of course, as you continue to raise pricing, you're threatening to impact churn. Every time you raise price, some portion of customers are going to churn. And the question is whether or not it's worth it because of the revenues you're able to get in the short term. And I think if you're thinking of a private equity company, and some of the problems people have with PE companies is they're not long-term owners. So they're able to effectively withdraw from the tail end of the customer lifetime value to push up more revenues in the short term when they actually own the company. And then they won't be around when the service degrades or the price is so high that people are churning. It has less of an impact on that because they won't actually be there for that. So whether or not they're doing the right mix, I have no idea. I wouldn't be one to say. I'm sure they have all sorts of models that try to predict these things, but at the end of the day, that is ultimately why having a good manager is so important, because they're going to be the ones that are making those sorts of decisions. And it's tricky because there are some businesses where your direct end consumer may not be the one whose goodwill really matters. So let's say if you're thinking of like Evolution Gaming, it's the operators. And for those that don't know Evolution Gaming, they make live casino games. And so this would be, they literally have a studio in, you know, Riga, Latvia, with several hundred different dealers dealing cards with video cameras on them. And then you could bet online. And so it's live casino play. And this is global, not legal everywhere. But if you're thinking of that, their customers are the operators. And so they have these game lobbies where they'll have Evolution, they'll have all these other games within them. And operators pretty much universally hate Evolution, but they hate them because they are so good and their product's so good that customers want their product so badly that Evolution can charge a much higher rate than anyone else. and the competition isn't competent enough to offer them the same level of service. And so you have this kind of layer within that where you have the game supplier, the operator, and then the customer. The operator is the one whose goodwill doesn't really matter. They're essentially getting, you know, squeezed out, somewhat modularized in a way, but it doesn't matter because ultimately, as long as the consumer likes the product and the consumer's not directly paying for it, it's okay. And it's a little bit like that when you think of Amazon. If you continue to take rates up on the merchants, maybe you do see some byproduct of prices increasing, but there's enough competition on the platform that that doesn't really happen, at least at the extremes. And so it's ultimately the consumer who is benefiting there as long as the cost continues to be borne on the merchants. And you see the same thing with Copart. I know you've looked at them where they'll continue to just take the take rates up on the buyer side, and insurance companies who have more leverage in that relationship have a much, much lower take rate.
Yeah, I mean, in Amazon's case, I think people tend to think about the merchants as companies trying to maximize a given margin, right? But I think we've got used to that because we research public companies where obviously margins are important because you have a valuation multiple. But if you're selling on Amazon and you are getting a lot of volume, so long as you are profitable, then you're going to get a lot of absolute profits, right? Maybe your margins are coming down, but you're still profitable and you're getting a lot of volume. If you leave Amazon, maybe you're going to have a higher margin, but you're going to have much less volume. So then your absolute profits are going to be lower. And I think you also talked there about an interesting topic, right? Because you talked about the importance of management. And I think a lot of people that focus on moat tend to disregard management, right? Because I think Peter Lynch's quote that buy any business that an idiot can run because an idiot will eventually run it. I think that probably got needs context, right? I think it was a different time, obviously. Now things change quite fast. And obviously maybe a management team cannot erode a moat by themselves, but certainly a streak of bad management teams can for sure erode a moat. So how do you think about the importance of management, and what do you look for in high quality management? I know that you probably focus quite a bit on management, and I would also like to know your view around the incentive structure.
Yeah. I think obviously management's very important. I think to give the Peter Lynch quote a little more credence, I think the idea is that could a business be so good or could a product be so good that anyone could sell it, basically? And, you know, off the top of my head, maybe you think of Chipotle, where Steve Ellis ran that for a while, and it still, you know, grew and did pretty well by measures of, you know, most restaurants failing because it was such a strong concept. But clearly, they had a lot of missteps, and it needed that next level of management to take them to the next level. And I don't know enough about the story. I'm sure there's a lot of aspects within that, but clearly, management changed, and the business and the success of the business changed a lot alongside with that. There's some businesses where management's clearly more important than others. I don't know that it's ever unimportant. If you think of kind of like, you know, the toll bridge that everyone likes to think about, I can imagine a manager, you know, messing that up. If they take pricing so high that they get regulators involved and maybe they lose their monopoly on the bridge and they publicize it, it's not impossible to think of such a situation. It is interesting, though, that we tend to think, you know, you could kind of make both arguments. You could say a great business is one where you don't need a great manager because just the aspects of the business are so strong. Or you could say maybe the manager is so great that an otherwise commodity business is now looking like a great business. And Walker & Dunlop, I'm sure people are not familiar with that one. That is a commercial real estate financing. And they have a few businesses, but they operate in the niche of helping lenders, helping getting people who are buying buildings, GSE financing. So Freddie Mae, Fannie Mae financing. And so the CEO of that company, Willie Walker, he's been at it for 20 years. He's, you know, been quoted saying, and we have these quotes in our reports, that this business has no moats because they have a lot of loan brokers, and the loan brokers can leave at any time. They could go to the highest bidder. And so they have no kind of traditional moats, as you think about it, because the actual client loyalty lies with the broker. And still, though, they've been a phenomenal company. They've 100x their value in the past couple decades. And that I would credit because he is such a good manager. He's able to foster some sort of culture there that's able to keep them, but also just being very competent at their job. So these brokers don't want to leave and potentially lose clients where maybe the back office messes something up and then it pisses off their client and they leave. And so those are those are things that are definitely copyable. You know, you could have a big bank saying, we want to be number one in this space, and that would be a problem for them. It hasn't happened yet, but that is somewhere where it's just management and competence that really has allowed them to excel in, you know, essentially a commodity business. And so management's clearly important. They are the ones that will be allocating all of the capital over, or essentially all of the capital over a long enough period of time. And so you want to make sure the capital allocation decisions they're making are good. And, you know, kind of back to the goodwill discussion, they're not only not over extracting goodwill, but they're not kind of frivolously losing goodwill as well. And there's lots of ways management can lose goodwill and not even, and it's not even like them monetizing it, right? And so if you're going to lose goodwill, you want to at least get a return for doing so, you know, increasing your pricing. But you don't want it to be like we just fumbled some sort of mistake, like, you know, Meta did many times over, where a lot of the privacy scandals and kind of access they gave their third-party developers early on, I don't know that that really did much in terms of allowing them to monetize their business, but they certainly suffered for it a lot in terms of press. And maybe, you know, long-term usage really hasn't been impacted that much for it, but they definitely lost goodwill for it.
Mm-hmm. No, I think the way I would frame it is that if you are a great business, good management is not going to do, bad management is not going to destroy the moat, right? But if you have great management, that great management is going to maximize the output per $1 of input, right? And the bad management is surely going to enjoy good returns, right? Because the business characteristics help it. But a great management team that's able to maximize that return, maybe in a given year, it doesn't matter. But over a 10-year period, it matters a lot, right? And also, what is the state of the company when that manager leaves, right? I mean, you have a bad manager, the moat is still there, but maybe its durability has been impacted to an extent, right? Because things could have done better. Whereas a great manager will get the business and probably leave it in a better state that he found it. So obviously that increases the durability of the business. And I think this jumps perfectly to the next topic. It's a topic that I tend to call durability or survivability, right? I mean, to compound returns over the long term, you need two things. One, we already said it, is to have a moat, then to be able to have a reinvestment runway to reinvest that at high rates of return during a long time. But obviously, something that sometimes get underappreciated, maybe because investment horizons have shrunk quite a bit, is for how many years the company is going to be able to do that. And that's not only a question of reinvestment runway, but also of how durable the business is. Why is it going to survive all the black swans that eventually are going to come? So I think that there's two ways to look at this. One is probably the business itself, right? How resilient it is. And the other one is probably through the capital structure. So do you... I think the question here is, are you more of an efficient capital structure guy? So one that wants to see companies maximize returns, or one that prefers to see maybe companies leave some returns on the table, but because they are trying to maximize the return, the time horizon through which they will be able to earn maybe a lower but also acceptable return?
Yeah. I'm probably more in the second camp. Like RH just did this, you know, they issued debt a couple of years ago and they just did this large buyback. I thought that was a little premature, not because I don't think that they'll be able to do the sort of business improvements longer term that they expect to be able to do, but just having, you know, that kind of debt on a business and then not in kind of giving up, if you will, you know, your safety, your margin of safety there, does make me a little more uncomfortable for sure. The amount of businesses, I think, that kind of push it to the limit and it ends up being okay in the end are not many. I think there's more likely than not, if you're focusing on optimizing the sort of capital stack of the company, that kind of suggests you're at kind of towards the end of your life, if you will, of really going after your core market. And, you know, you could think of someone like AutoZone. I'm sure they have certain moats within that business that are great, but really what's made it a great stock is the financial model they've had, where they look at accounts payable they focus on accounts payable as a percent of revenue, and they're basically very good at strong arming suppliers to pay them on a delayed terms, using that as a source of funding to continue to grow, and then at the same time buying back a lot of stock. And they bought back something like 90% of their company since they IPO'd in 1998. And all of that is, you know, the sort of financial model. So there's definitely examples where it does make all of the difference. And so it's not really an either or thing, but you definitely want the company to be able to last and to be able to last in environments that you can't foresee currently. And so if you do get, like, you know, a very long recession, maybe even a depression, you don't want to be, it's tricky because we tend to not think of these scenarios. You know, the depression, Great Depression, was a long time ago. But if we do get a depression, what's going to happen to your companies, to your portfolios? Are they all levered so much that now that a bunch are going to go bankrupt? And you never even thought of that as a possibility prior. But that's, you know, things that have happened before can happen again, and things that are remote can happen as well. And so I would tend to just be a little bit more conservative on that. But there's, you know, certainly different investing styles. And a lot of that also matters on the number of bets you're making and how your portfolio is diversified. If you are, you know, a VC company, we're more okay with impairment of capital because you have so many bets and you're expecting the upside of a couple bets to more than offset all of that. So it does also matter how someone is looking at their portfolio. And we wrote a memo called the Investment Matching Principle, which is basically the idea that you need to balance the risk reward of your portfolio with the actual number of bets that you're making. And so if you have something that has a very high probability of earning a very high return with low impairment of capital, it's okay to size that up. Whereas if it has a probability of total impairment of capital, but a very high return, even if it's remote, then you need a lot of those bets to sort of make that work. And so it's sort of like the expected value equation, essentially, but also thinking about the number of bets that you're making. And, you know, if you are talking about capital structure and leverage and all that, it's also important to think where the leverage lies. I don't know. I think you talked about the Constellation Software AGM recently, and Mark Leonard had some interesting comments on debt there, where he actually, it was interesting, his one takeaway from a lot of the press Charlie Munger was doing recently was that he thought that Charlie Munger kind of regretted the amount of leverage that they put on Berkshire. And he was saying that had they have used more leverage, they would have outperformed S&P. But Buffett didn't want to do that because he kind of wanted to be this backstop of the U.S. economy in this worst case scenario. And that is an interesting thing to think about. It's also interesting to think about, forget the returns that could have happened if there was another sort of financial crisis scenario. What would have happened if there was something like a depression? In that case, maybe it would have really only have been Berkshire and very few other large companies that were able to withstand it. And so it is somewhat a disposition and what your goals are as an investor, thinking about how much safety you want. But back to the Constellation point, it matters where the debt is. They have a lot of debt on the company level. If they're doing a large acquisition, it's ring fenced. So if that company itself goes bankrupt, it doesn't take down the whole conglomerate. And that goes back to kind of thinking of your portfolio sizing as well. You don't want any one bad thing to take down your portfolio. So you want all your risks to be independent.
Mm-hmm. I think Hermes is also an interesting example because they have like a huge cash pile. I don't know if it's like 10 or 11 billion or something like that in the balance sheet, and they have no debt. And obviously, analysts always ask them, like, what are you going to do with all this cash? And they're like, yeah, we're not going to do anything. That's like our safety net in case something happens. And they say, and an analyst told them, like, but what can happen so that you need 10 billion? And the CEO said, like, I don't know, a pandemic, like the one that we just suffered. I mean, who would have foreseen a pandemic 5 years ago or before the pandemic? Nobody, right? And that was a situation where all of your stores are closed. So, I mean, if you would have told someone in 2015, hey, you know that you're going to be like 6 months with your stores closed, they would be like, what? I mean, there's no scenario under that happens. And it happened, right? I always go back to a quote from David Giroux's book called Capital Allocation. And I'm paraphrasing here, but he says something like, if you own a company and that company doesn't pay you dividends and goes bankrupt and generates and is growing 15% per year in like value enhancing way, and in the 20th year it goes bankrupt without paying out dividend, that company is worth zero today. So, I mean, because basically you didn't get anything out of there unless you sold it. If you hold it till bankruptcy, the value is zero. And that's something like worth thinking about, right? Because if you're investing for very long periods and you own companies that are continuously reinvesting into the business, then survival becomes a very, very important topic. Obviously, if you buy a company that's paying you 12%, a 12% yield per year, then survival is probably a less important important discussion. But I think it's an interesting discussion nonetheless. I mean, there's one thing in common, right, across bankruptcies, and that's probably leverage, to a greater or to a smaller extent. But it's pretty hard to go bankrupt if you have a net cash position that it's like 100% of your operating income, right? You're also forfeiting returns over the short term. That's for sure. Or maybe you're not forfeiting returns as a company, but you're forfeiting your shareholders' return because you're not paying that cash out.
I think that's a really good point. And if you are doing the DCF, most people probably notice that if you're taking the sum of the first 10 years of cash flow, it's a very small portion of the overall valuation. Most of the valuation is very much backloaded, and you might have an implied lifetime of, 80 years on the company. That's very common, even though people may not be comfortable making that assumption. So the idea that you do want a company to have longevity is even suggested in the numbers, that it's more valuable for a company to be around a long time and continue to generate what cash they're generating than to push that up some of those cash flows a few years by doing like a dividend recap or something like that.
I was going to go to another topic, but I think this brings a very interesting topic. I mean, the high quality companies typically trade at high multiples, right? At optically high multiples. Why do you think, despite these companies being known by a lot of people, right? And the quality is being well known. I mean, I think a lot of people know that Costco is a high quality business, or maybe Constellation Software at this point. Why do you think that these companies, despite being so, let's say, apparent, are able to continue to outperform over the long term? Do you think it's because the market, as you said, focuses maybe on those first 5 years and maybe undervalues the durability of these companies? I mean, on average, it's very tough, right, for a company to earn outsized returns for 4 decades. I would say that's like the very, very special companies. But do you think that the market tends also to discount these companies as if they were not going to be able to achieve this over the next 10, 20 years?
Yeah, I think truly great companies tend to do things that you don't expect. And I think the tricky part as an investor is you can't expect them to do things that you shouldn't, that they don't expect to do. So, if you, and Mark Leonard was asked the question, because I think he said in like 2016 or 17 that the stock seemed overpriced, and someone asked him, okay, what happened over the past 8 years that has surprised you? And he said, we grew a lot more than I expected us to. And part of that is them, moving into these larger acquisitions. Part of that is them taking on a little bit more debt, so they're able to lower their hurdle rate without the return on equity dropping much. But, a great company tends to be able to do things more than you would want to conservatively assume. Having said that, I do think there's a little bit of a feedback loop that once that kind of gets into the general lexicon that someone expects a great company to do great things, that then they start pricing that into the market. And so I don't want to take an opinion on some of these high quality stocks that have very high multiples. I don't know that, the future is going to be the same as the past, because maybe now the expectation is that they will continue to perform for a long period of time. That's why, I like to simplify it with the reverse DCF, just to see what the assumptions are within that stock. And a lot of times you'll find that, generalizing, a lot of times you'll find that if you are looking at a great company, you do the reverse DCF, you see what conservative assumptions are. The return is not great, but it's usually higher than the risk-free rate. And so my assumption there is that people are just considering it to be a lot safer of an investment. And that's why they're more comfortable maybe paying up for it. Even if the return isn't as great as it will be in the past, they kind of see that distribution of returns as being more narrow. And for that reason, they might like it. Then again, it's always hard to describe or ascribe meaning to what the market is doing, because how many people are actually doing real analysis is always a question.
I think that's a great point, right? Because, for example, if you look at Constellation, let's say 10 years ago, and they would have told you that Constellation would be deploying more than $2 billion at a very high rate, you probably would have said that you're crazy, right? I mean, they'll reach a ceiling that there's no way that they're going to achieve this. But at the same time, if you would have said the opposite, both would have been I'd say it would have been more reasonable, the person who said, it's not going to last, like, let's say 10 years at this rate, incremental capital invested, right? But then it happened, right? But as you said, it's dangerous to underwrite that it will happen over the next 10 years, and probably it's much safer to wait for a moment where the market doesn't believe that it will continue, because obviously these companies also go through those moments when the whole market is down. I mean, some companies go down more than others, but they also go down, right? And at that point, you can do your reverse DCF, as you say, and maybe the assumptions are not as crazy to have a very good return. I think it's an interesting topic, right? Because everyone says, no, look at this company, everything's priced in. And then you look in 5 years and maybe that company has beaten the market and it's like, well, everything was not priced in, right? Because you cannot price in the unknowable. And these companies also have, they achieve something that not many do, which is to have very durable growth. And at the same time, they can also come up with new revenue sources, right? It all goes back to optionality. I mean, who could have expected Amazon to come up with AWS? Probably no one, and it would have been crazy to bet on it. But you were not betting maybe on AWS, but you were probably betting on the culture coming up with something, right? Maybe it wasn't AWS, but it was something different. And so I think here another very important topic is culture, right? And here when I talk about culture, I think about Danaher. I mean, they started with they were an industrial business at first, and then they have been pivoting towards bioprocessing and life sciences. But at the end, the culture has never changed, right? They bought businesses and they improved them every day through continuous improvement, and they generated great returns. I mean, the management team was not focused maybe on any given industry, but on an industry where they could achieve high returns. If it's life sciences today, maybe in 15 years it will be another industry, right? So how do you value, or how do you look at culture, and how important do you think it is? I mean, this is, I think, one of the most qualitative probably topics of high quality companies, but probably also what sets them apart and something that's not tangible and maybe that the market probably underappreciates in some cases, right? I mean, Danaher, a very good chunk of its success can be attributed purely to its culture, and Amazon the same, right? Because they have this culture of reinvention, and we would have probably not see Amazon Ads or AWS if it's not for the culture. But at the same time, you cannot value the culture based on AWS or Ads because you never knew that they were coming.
Yeah, culture, it matters a lot, and it's kind of also too amorphous to really talk about or value most of the time. I tend to try to find the, specific examples within businesses that can kind of speak to the culture. A lot of that, it's usually set to by the founder. So if the founder is still involved, you kind of get a better sense of what the culture is, and they tend to be stewards of the culture. And then within that, we talked, or you mentioned incentives earlier. Incentives are also really important, and I would, include that as part of the culture, sort of like a long-term mindset. And so, it is hard to really find out a lot about the culture as an outside observer, but you could do enough. If Floor & Decor was one of the companies we looked at, we talked about them briefly. They're, they sell a lot of hard surface flooring for those that are unfamiliar with it out of these big warehouse models, and they'll have chief executive merchants at every warehouse store. And they'll give them autonomy to basically select the different merchandising within their store that does the best. And so a lot of times, kind of giving out some delegation, especially to lower level employees, tends to be a positive thing. It tends to have them believe they have more job satisfaction, but also just outsourcing some of the decision making to someone who is most capable of being able to make that decision is important. And so the CEMs at Floor & Decor, they're not only merchandising all the store, they have the ability to really do a lot within that store. And I follow a bunch of them on LinkedIn, and they're always posting about the different goals they're hitting, the way they're motivating their employees, and all of that. And so giving people autonomy, delegation, that's definitely a factor within that. And it goes back to your Amazon point, the fact that they let someone, go and run off with the idea of AWS, That is delegation, that is autonomy there. And there's a story of Pony Ma, who's a founder of Tencent. There's a Chinese idiom that translates roughly to one race, two horses. And so he was a fan of having multiple teams pit against each other for the same sort of product or service they're creating. And one of them was WeChat, and everyone, if you're unfamiliar with that, that is, you know, the largest app in China, basically. It's a only super app really that exists. It does everything from messaging to has many stores within it, many apps within it. People use it multiple times every day. And when they were transitioning from their legacy social network, if you will, which was called QQ, there was one team that was making QQ mobile, and then another team led by Alan Chung, who was going to create this other mobile app, and that was called WeChat. And had they not have had that second team also go after that, they maybe would have missed the mobile opportunity, because ultimately it was WeChat was the one that was able to win that mobile opportunity and be a very popular app, whereas QQ Mobile did okay. It never kind of reached the same sort of level. And so that is, it goes back to culture, this idea that the founder too is going to be the one that kind of sets the tone of the culture. And, you know, you want some level of competition, you want autonomy, you want delegation, you want everyone to be incentivized in the right direction. Constellation Software, of course, is a poster child of this, where they don't give them stock, but they make them buy stock with their own cash. And you want them to all be incentivized. And that those are some of the things. But of course, it's a kind of a wandering answer, because culture is all over the place. You could think about Costco. Costco pays all of their members very well. And the idea of paying them well is they're going to work harder and the churn is going to be less on the employee side. So we're going to spend less money training people. That's something within culture, within their culture too, is, you know, a set markup of 13 to 14%. And so no matter what, it's already locked in the amount of money that they're going to make. And so the whole culture is not set to try to make the most money off the customer. The whole idea is, since our margins are already basically locked in, let's sell the most stuff. And so all of that, there's many factors, and you could talk about culture for a very long time. It's very important, but there is no really one size fit all model. And there's companies that maybe look at them like CoStar, for example. It's known as being a very hard company to work at. I don't know that job satisfaction is incredibly that high, but if you're a really good salesperson, you could do very well there. So they tend to attract those very competent people. But there's a lot of people like that that may not want to work there.
Mm-hmm. I think Amazon is a very good example, right? In the, let's say, the relationship between incentives and culture. I recommend for any listeners or readers here that have never read Amazon's proxy statement, I think it's quite underappreciated. I think it's one that people like take for granted, right? Because it's Amazon, everyone knows it. But I think it's quite a special proxy statement, right? You can see a company saying that they're not going to base compensation on certain operational metrics, because if that is going to lead the managers to optimize for those. And what they want is managers to go out and invent the next big business. And they give actually a good example, saying that if they would have compensated management for selling more books, then probably, or for selling more in their stores, then probably AWS would have never come out, right? Never came out, because they wouldn't have had the incentive to go after that. I think after all the conversation, people probably have an idea of what a high quality company is for us. So I think it would be great if we close it with some, let's say, real examples, right? So I want to ask you, what is the highest quality? And obviously, a company is not going to, it's very rare for a company to satisfy all of the traits of a high quality company, right? No company is perfect, and maybe they do poorly in some things, but maybe great in others. In fact, I would say that if a company is saying that they are perfect, then that's probably an orange flag, because obviously companies can improve some things all the time. So what would you say is the highest quality company that you've ever researched?
Yeah, I'm glad you let me go first, because I was worried you'd steal Copart.
Oh, I was actually going to steal it. But this is great, because then we can have a conversation.
I think something else, just real quick to talk about, I would say, is kind of the operating model of the business and the way different elements of the business sort of interlock. And I have this piece I call the PEDEN network. A PEDEN is a mountain climbing tool. And the idea there is that there's this mountain climbing tool that both suspends you, but it also supports you at the same time. And you could go off into a different direction with that. But for now, the reason why I'm bringing that up is this idea that businesses sort of place these PEDENs in the ground and they become interlocked over time. And the way that they are interlocked together usually in and of itself creates a formidable advantage, because it's no longer are you trying to attack one aspect of the business. You have to attack multiple aspects at the same time, but you can't even attempt to attack the first aspect until you get that first PEDEN in, which you can't do. And so if you're thinking about a company like Copart, you can't even begin to compete against them until you get the land. You can't get the land, though, until you're very unlikely to be able to get the land, though, unless you also are able to get the insurance contracts and volumes that will support the economics of owning that land in the first place. And you can't get the insurance companies to sign up in the first place unless you get a marketplace to actually sell the cars. You can't get a marketplace to sell the cars until you actually have cars to sell. And so it's like multiple chicken and egg problems kind of wrapped into one. And if you're thinking about how am I going to compete against Copart, not only are you going to have to get this land that doesn't really exist in your more near city centers, it's not zoned for salvage. It's very hard to get salvage zoning because of a lot of environmental laws. Now, on top of that, then you also have to get integrations directly with the insurance companies. Not only are they getting contracted out all the supply to the insurance companies, very often they're even telling the insurance companies what cars to total or not because of their pro quote tool, which you can't do unless you have all this data. You can't have all this data unless you have the marketplace, and on and on. There's multiple layers to that. I have a whole 2-hour podcast on Copart at the synopsis if anyone wants to listen to that. But just kind of those are some of the aspects of Copart, why the business is so hard to compete against. You have these sort of multiple different moats that any one of them would create a good business. But since they all kind of interlock, it makes it very near impossible. And then in terms of ownership and incentives, Willis Johnson, Jay Adair, the founder, and his son-in-law, who's also been very involved from early on, they're still very involved in the business. Management has been superb. It helps that their largest competitor has been pretty inept, IAA. Although, you know, IAA itself, even though relatively inept, it on its own has been a decent business. That's mostly because the industry is great. But you do see a lot of those great things, high ROIC. The runway is decent too. Maybe it's not as long as you would want it because you'd want them to be able to invest as much money as possible into this, but they are still going international and there still is a lot of investment opportunity there. So that does hit on a lot of aspects of a great business.
I think Copart versus IAA probably is an example of what we talked about before about great management and probably mediocre management, right? Because at the end, one is eating share little by little. And when you realize they are the largest player and you cannot do anything to take that share back. And Copart is very interesting because I think it's one of those rare companies that has both a physical moat and a network effect moat, and both are depending on each other, right? So you could think about network effects as being capital light in nature. So maybe someone can viralize something and go against your network effect. I mean, that's been the criticism of Meta for a long time. Maybe an app comes by like TikTok and they can achieve that network effect. But in Copart's case, you cannot do that until you don't have the land. So going after the network effect becomes like super capital intensive, and probably obviously you have the regulatory barriers. I think what's very interesting in the last earnings call, I think management said that they own the land, whereas some competitors, well, IAA, for example, leases much of that land. And the problem with leasing that land is that when the lease is over, the owner can try to get it repurposed for another thing because they believe it's a better use of capital. So then you might end up not having that land. But in their case, obviously, they decide what they want to repurpose that land for or whatever. So it's much more protected against the future.
Yeah, and it kind of goes back to your earlier question on kind of how whether or not the company should like push the financial limits or be more conservative. Copart was buying a lot of its land very early on, and it bought way more land than it needed just because it saw it as so integral to part of their model, whereas IAA was much more concerned about Wall Street and the financial returns and would say, oh, well, you know, if we lease it instead of buying it, then we're like a capital light model or something like that. Instead, to your point, what they figured out was the real value was in the land. And so if there's only one lot that's licensed for salvage vehicles in a given city, guess who's going to be able to demand what the price is for that? The person who owns the lot. And so then IAA a lot of times would have to, when they re-sign the lease, they're paying up a lot for that. And so their ROIC was a lot lower as a result of that.
Yeah, I mean, and Copart also understood from the get-go that insurers were coming to them due to the platform's liquidity, right? The liquidity at auction. And to create like high returns and auction liquidity, they needed a lot of buyers. So they went to online, like I think it was 2004 or something like that. Whereas IAA fully transitioned when the pandemic struck. So it was a forced transition more than a strategical decision. I think that's also very important, right? Because now it's very hard to disrupt the Copart's buyer base, because Copart's buyers know that if they're looking for a car, it's going to be at Copart. So why are they going to look elsewhere? Whereas if a buyer goes to IAA, they can say, okay, maybe it's here, but maybe it's not. So, but I know it's going to be for sure in Copart. And obviously all those eyes brings more models and more cars, because insurers are giving you more volume. So actually I'd say it's one of the highest quality business that I know too. And also a very good example of the efficient capital structure versus survivability, right? I mean, Copart has no debt. I think it retires the little debt it has when interest rates started to rise. And they have, if I'm not mistaken, I'm speaking of memory here, maybe $3 billion in cash or something like that. So when they get asked about that cash, they basically say that cash is obviously to reinvest in the business if they find opportunities, but also to give their customers comfort that if everything goes like south, that Copart is going to be there for them, right? Because I mean, if you're in a recession, probably insurers are not going to be in the best place, and they know that the Copart is going to be there, and Copart is not going to go bankrupt, because if Copart goes bankrupt, they're not going to find a place to sell their cars as efficiently.
Yeah, actually, we have this chart in our Copart report on their stock repurchases, and they've really been superb, because they, for a long time, were kind of against repurchases. Mostly of that was a byproduct of the fact that they needed to grow and become, get sort of national density. Was very important to be the first one there. But then around 2007, they started repurchasing their stock. They were a little conservative with it. Then the financial crisis hits and they paused their buybacks, and they realized that the business was totally fine through that. And when they had that understanding, the resilience of the business, they realized they could actually be more aggressive in the stock repurchases, especially at that valuation. And they actually did two debt issuances just to buy back more stock within a few years. And that, again, it kind of goes back to capital allocation. It goes back to good management. It goes back to understanding your business. At that point, that was those repurchases they did at the time. I don't know exactly if it's like 15x or something like that since then. Obviously very attractive, but it was very interesting because they changed their thinking of it in response to the way the business acted in one of the worst economic calamities. And at the same time, then they didn't just buy back stock. They actually went the other way and issued debt as well to buy back stock, which I can't think of many other companies that are so selective in their buybacks and so aggressive when they come. RH does come to mind, but they're not quite as resilient of a business as Copart is.
Yep. And I think that also portrays why having a strong financial position is important, right? Because you have the opportunity to do that when it matters. I mean, if you go to the financial crisis with an over-levered balance sheet, then probably you're not going to be able to issue a lot of debt to go to repurchase share. But if right now we have a recession and Copart has $3 billion in the bank, well, I think they are able, and obviously the business is resilient. I mean, it was resilient throughout a pandemic, right? Where people did not drive as much. But then I start to think that Copart is also isolated to an extent against that, right? Because when there's no traffic, then people speed more, and then they can have like faster accidents, which leads to total loss. What I got from studying Copart or from researching Copart is that it's a business that it's protected against probably everything, right? I mean, if you see their KPIs, when one moves up, then there's going to be some other KPI that's going to sort of offset what's happening to that KPI. And right now it's going through a period where something that didn't happen in the past is happening, right? That you have lower ASPs, so total loss ratio is going up again, but the ASPs are not going down as much. So they are like kind of in the sweet spot where they are getting a lot of volume and they are still being able to sell it at high ASPs. Probably the most, I mean, not everything is great. What do you think? I mean, I have a pretty strong opinion on this, but what do you think on the risk of autonomy or autonomous driving ultimately impacting the company's terminal value?
Yeah, I mean, that's another one where you could just kind of do the math of it and invert the question. And so you could say there's 300 some million vehicles in North America. Let's say we're selling, you know, 20 million vehicles a year. So 15 years to replace the vehicle stock. What percentage of cars are going to be AV in any given year? We don't even have, you know, mass sale of AV cars. Even if you're assuming, you know, all Teslas are like fully autonomous today, it's still, you're looking at like a multi-decade period to flip all of the car stock within the US. And then if only some vehicles are autonomous and not others, does that mean that there's less accidents or just as many? Does that mean that the cost of repair continues to go up? And, you know, you're talking about some of the factors of Copart that, you know, the offsets and all that with ASPs and volumes. They've had this huge tailwind for the better part of a couple decades where the cost of repair just continues to increase. And as we get more sensors and more technologies in cars, that's going to also just continue to happen. And so that also is potentially another offset where you do have less accidents, but the accidents that do happen, they're higher total losses, higher rate that they're going to be totaled. And so I would kind of expect that to happen for some time. So in a long enough time frame, it seems that we'll eventually get AV'd. I think that maybe it takes a little bit longer than some people expect, but the bigger thing is just how long does it take to replace all of the vehicle stock in the US? And that's going to take a long time, especially if we're taking affordability into account.
Mm-hmm. No, the cost to repair is actually crazy because the other day someone like bumped in the back of my car. So I have to change. It's basically a plastic piece, the back bumper. And I did like a little bit of research when I took the car to the repair shop. And I asked the lady that was in charge, I mean, like, how much is this going to cost? I mean, I'm not going to pay for it. It's obviously an insurance company. And she told me that piece of plastic is 700 euros, only the piece. And then you have to add the repair, like the labor.
The service, yeah.
Yeah, and she even told me that some insurers, costs have gone up so much that some insurers were prohibiting repair shops from putting official pieces. Like they prefer if they could be like secondhand or if they could be even false. They didn't care, but that the costs were too high to bear. And that's crazy, right? Because if that's 800 euros in my car that's new and it's a piece of plastic, if I like break my cameras and my sensor that are in front, probably in 2 or 3 years time, the car is like 2 years old, but in 2 or 3 years time, probably it starts to come into question that maybe it's a total loss, right? Because maybe the repair is 8,000 euros and probably the car in 5 years time, because cars depreciate very fast, it's not going to be worth that.
Yeah, I mean, well, very much, you know, the trend has been for the repair cost to increase because of not only technology, but also just service has been going up, fewer skilled laborers in the area as well. I think one of the bigger understated risk of Copart is if for some reason the cost of repair would go down. And maybe that's because you get like more modularized parts. There was some factor where for a long time you had to use like OEM software to like reset it. That was like much more expensive. And then there are some case against that, and so they're allowed to use third-party diagnostics tools. And so or maybe there's some sort of automation that can happen or something. If there was something that could bring that repair cost down, that would be a risk. But I also like to think of like how far-fetched you have to think about your risk, and then you could think about that in terms of, you know, basically the quality of the business. So if you're thinking about there having to be you know, some sort of modularized car that is built just to be really cheap to repair and gets huge broad adoption.
And you have to think, of that while probably the car manufacturer is making most of its profit by repairing like the repair parts and all that. So probably they are going, I mean, it's against their business model to make it very cheap to repair, right? Because they are making a lot of money from that. And they also, the repair shops are also making quite a bit of money. But yeah, I mean, you're right. When you start to think about like super tail, like tail risks, then you start to think, okay, maybe this business is quite resilient. And I mean, they can play out, right? But again, investing is a game of probabilities. I mean, it's not just the risk, but how probable the risk is to come. And regarding autonomous driving, I mean, we don't even have a well-functioning autonomous technology that people trust, right? I mean, I can have a right now autonomous in my car, and I probably would drive it because I wouldn't trust it. And I mean, autonomous is not autonomous if you have to be like with your hands on the wheel like that, just in case the car goes like that and then you have to correct, right? That's not the autonomous that would hurt Copart.
Yeah. And I can promise you, if you don't trust it, it'll be that much longer until regulators do as well, just because the burden of proof very much is on them, not just creating a safer car than a human driver, but, you know, a magnitude of a safer car. And anytime there's ever going to be a story, even if it is like, you know, 90% reduction in fatalities on AV cars, that may not be good enough, because the AV stories that do come out of an autonomous vehicle killing someone will be enough that, you know, regulators are probably going to pause the project.
Yeah, I mean, we've been like decades reducing the number of deaths in accidents. I don't think they're going to risk that number going up again. And also, there's another question, right? Who's going to bear the responsibility of that accident? Because I mean, is it going to be, am I going to sign a paper that says that I'm responsible if anything happens, even if the car is driving on autonomous? Or is it going to be the manufacturer that says, okay, the software failed, it was my fault? I think, I don't know, insurance companies probably have a say on that debate too.
Yeah. I mean, I would imagine it doesn't matter, or it's just the insurance company. And then maybe the insurance companies fight over whether or not it was software that malfunctioned or whatnot, but I wouldn't imagine.
Probably similar to an aircraft accident, probably.
Mm-hmm.
Right, when I mean, you have to solve a lot of things. And then, as you said, you have to replace all the vehicle fleet. So before the episode, I actually took some notes. And actually, my company was Copart too. So I think that I think portrays what a high quality company Copart is. It's obviously not trading cheap, because if it were trading cheap, then it would make no sense. But at the end, and one last topic that came to me with Copart is the topic of guidance or no guidance, right? I mean, I did the other day, I asked a question whether you felt comfortable with guidance or with maybe a company not issuing guidance, because Copart doesn't issue guidance, right? So basically, analysts are free to make the estimates, and surprise, they never get it right, because they don't have any guidance. Yeah. Well, probably they have some calls with management and they can imagine. But do you prefer, or do you think it's beneficial for a company to not provide guidance, because maybe the guidance can lead to, let's say, perverse behavior in the management team? Or what are your thoughts around that?
Yeah, I think any sort of forecasting is going to be mostly correct when it doesn't matter and vastly wrong when it does matter. And so you can do these sort of quarterly forecast games for a while, and it doesn't really matter that much quarter to quarter, because it's mostly, you know, linear. And then something like a pandemic hits and all your forecasting was wrong. That was the one instance where it actually mattered. And so I'm not a big fan of the quarterly forecasting or even annual. I do like it though when a management team will set a long-term target, maybe 5 years out, maybe even longer, and say, this is our goal, this is what we want to hit. And then if you could look back on history and see that they put out these big goals and actually hit them, that is a great way to actually build trust in the management team. And CoStar with Andy Florence was great at that. They'll put out a very large 5-year goal. Ones that don't, you know, right now their 5-year goal for 2027 now, because it's been a couple of years past, is $5 billion in revenue. And they're only doing about 2.7 this year, 2.8. And so whether or not they hit it is very much in question. And so it is good that when a management team has enough confidence to put out kind of aspirational targets. And then also if we could see historically whether or not they hit them, that I find quite helpful. Floor Decor, in contrast, is big on, you know, quarterly and short-term guidance. I'm not someone who reads into like short-term guidance and looks at these short-term trends, but even I could tell a year ago when they were giving their guidance and they weren't changing it as the markets, then markets were changing, that it was going to be wrong. And that it kind of reminds me of, I think it's Horowitz quote, I'm blanking out his first name, but Andreessen Horowitz. It's one of his quotes where he says, if you're going to eat shit, don't nibble. And they would slowly take this guidance down, and then every quarter it was just like you're taking it down a little bit more, where it would have been better to just like reset expectations entirely if that's the game you're going to play. That's not a game I want my managers wasting their time playing, but if you are going to do this sort of quarterly game, it doesn't make sense to just try to appease what Wall Street wants or what the stock price wants to see. Instead, just, you know, put the numbers out as best you think they would be a little conservative.
I think what one great way to understand what you like, if management can be trusted, is to go back, let's say, 10 years and maybe read the earnings call of the Q4 of each year, right? So 10 earnings call. That way you are going to see not maybe formal guidance, long-term guidance, but maybe management saying, I think it will play out this way. And then you can see how it played out, or we think this is going to happen. So then you get a sense of like how good, like how well they know their business and how well they know their industry. And also because you can see the evolution of the company, right? I mean, I've been reading about Interactive Brokers lately, and I've read the earnings calls since the financial crisis. And obviously you see that during the financial crisis, they had a bad time, Interactive Brokers. But the business is not really comparable to what it is today, right? Because they had a market making business, which was the business that was very impacted. They divested or sort of wind down that business through the years, and now it's electronic brokerage only, which did great during the global financial crisis, right? So if you don't have the context to read how the company has evolved, you might go back, just look at the numbers of the global financial crisis and say, well, this business did poorly, but they did poorly because of a segment that is not even in the company today. So I think that's a great point, right? To get management trust, and it goes back to the point of implicit conviction. When you read this and you do the work and you know what management has said and has done, then it's when you generate that implicit conviction that ultimately is going to help you hold the company through tough times, right?
Yeah. No, I think it's important. That's why you do the deep research. That's why we started this conversation talking about history, because you do need to have that context to be able to add to it. Otherwise, you know, it's kind of like you're trying to drive without really knowing where you started the journey. So maybe you end up back at the same spot.
Yep. Completely agree. So, well, I think we've talked about a lot of things. I'll leave all the links in the description, right? I'll leave the link to Speedwell Research, to the podcast that we had, also to the Copart, your Copart research. I also leave podcast, right?
Either one. Yeah.
Okay. And thank you very much for coming, Drew. I think it was great. And so, thank you very much.
No, thank you for having me. Always a pleasure to talk to someone who is very well versed in businesses. So this was a joy.
Thank you.